Hey, we're back in the Stuck series here with an important topic. It's one we've talked about before, but we're trying to refine, and we might even be wrong. So it's going to be an important discussion. Welcome back.
Welcome to the Leading Edge in Emotionally Focused Therapy with your hosts, Dr. James Hawkins and Dr. Ryan Reyna. EFT is a dynamic model that humbles even the most seasoned therapists. Together, we want to come alongside you as you continually push the leading edge of your understanding and application of this wonderful model developed by Dr. Sue Johnson.
Yeah, Ryan, I definitely want to come back to this and visit it.
This being the toxic stories, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
Because I do think there is a part where we're still right. There's a part when we say toxic, it's not saying we're judging the overall story of every client that ever comes in. But what we say is there is a timing. There's one thing I heard George say on his Foreplay Radio. Sometimes it's timing of things, and there is also content of things.
Yeah.
And our clients, it's hard for them to know when the two meld together in the process.
Yeah.
So what I noticed in a tape of mine while I was showing out in Vegas, thank you for inviting me out to come train out there. What I wanted to help the participants with was, one, I had to confront them and show like, hey, here's a couple of choice points. I could have let that person keep going with that.
Right.
But if I let them go with that, one, it does them a disservice because there's only so much time on the clock. Two, then it leaves the part where they set something significant and it feels like it gets buried under a mound of more content. So then the very thing, the felt sense of closeness never gets to be for someone to come towards it. And also the way they tell the story while they're trying, I know that they're trying to tell a good intent. They don't realize how it's landing on their partner in the way that they tell the story. Because sometimes we can tell a story as I'm trying to tell you what's happening inside my brain, but it sounds like I'm telling a story that is I'm showing you how you are 100% completely guilty, and the way I'm telling this is who you are and how it is. But anyway, it's how to help them listen inside of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so just in case you just clicked on this episode and haven't listened to us before, I want to just zoom out. What we're talking about is the overuse of story at the wrong time in the clinical process. At times, we've called it the toxic story. We're going to unpack more of that today. So right at the moment when you're trying to take someone or help someone go a direction, a non-useful story comes in and blows the whole thing up. I would say, James, and you might disagree with this, I think this is the number two most common block system in the whole world. That's a big statement. I think number one is when I'm trying to go for vulnerability and I'm like, what's happening for you right now? Because that'd be an evocative responding intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell me why it's happening. That is as common as, you know, meeting for 60 minutes at a time.
Mm-hmm.
That one happens all the time. But this is right there. And this one is even more sly. Like you can tell if I say, what are you feeling or what's happening for your heart? My preferred way to say that. And you say, well, Nicola did this or this or this. That stands out pretty well.
Okay.
But these stories can seem like the person is answering the question. And that's what makes them so slippery, right? But you did a good job just off air saying, you know, if you let some story come in on one side, now the other person has got to tell their side of the story. And this storying becomes contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, you got 10 minutes left and mm-hmm. we're going to repeat next week. And this is a huge deal. And I see some pretty good therapists who don't see it or are not able to identify this story stuff. So it's a big deal. I want to say this. There's no question that what we're saying is accurate, in my mind at least. It's not that our idea is right, but this is right. I know this happens. I know that this destroys cases and sessions. What we might be wrong about is what language we're using.
Yeah.
Maybe story's not the right word. Mm-hmm. That can land funny on people.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. And I'll say this quick story. I don't even like this because I actually love stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's central to me. And I'll tell you this quick story. Maybe the best compliment I've ever gotten was in a baseball dugout. I'd love to say it's back when I was a player, but it wasn't. It's as a dad when my kid was like 6 years old, right? And I was like, hey, didn't you coach baseball? I'm like, yeah, like, come help us coach. Like, okay, so I was thinking we're going to talk about baseball, but I was the official shoe tire. That was my that was my job in the dugout. You know, my buddy to my right, who's like 10-tour military special forces guy, his job was the snacks. And my job was tying the little boy's shoes, six-year-olds. And it was either like we're winning, everyone's just throwing a party, or everybody's crying. That's how that was. So anyway, we'd been in this, just real quickly, we'd been in this team, this little boys team, for like 28 weeks or something ridiculous like that. And so he was just around me all the time as I engaged other people. And I was not even aware of this. Mm-hmm. And he pulled me aside and he gave me this great compliment. he goes, man, you're weird. I'm like, okay, that's probably true. And he goes, no, I made it as a compliment. He's like, you really care about people, don't you? I'm like, what? He's like, everybody you talk to, you interview them. You want to know where they're from.
Yeah.
You want to know where they went to school. You usually like memorize their high school mascot for some random reason, you know, and you want to know where they work. And you like just, and he's like, to be honest with you, I don't care. That's a great compliment. And I'm like, I didn't even know I was doing that.
Yes, you do.
But I'm just naturally curious. Yeah. And I'll take that as a compliment. So I say all that to say, I love stories. I really like to hear people's stories, especially, you know, when they're giving me a context of a deeper experience of getting to know someone. I think you can really get to know someone in their story. So I find it quite ironic that here we are pushing back on something that I actually love.
That's right.
But here's the problem. If I hire you, if I'm morbidly obese, all right? I know that could be a sensitive topic too, but if I'm morbidly obese and I'm hiring you and saying, hey, man, my life's on the line. I need you to help me lose weight. Mm-hmm. All right? And you're like, all right, I'm going to try to help you. I'm like, oh, but by the way, I'm going to go to McDonald's and I'm going to bring in 10 cheeseburgers and 20 French fries. And I do like their French fries. and you sit there and let me eat that in front of you. It's a problem, man.
Yeah.
Because I've made a significant contradiction to you. I'm like, help me lose weight while I'm eating too much of mm-hmm. food that's probably not healthy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we're dealing with mm-hmm. when we let too much toxic story mm-hmm. or some better phrase that I haven't figured out yet happen in the clinical process. So that's what we're meaning by this. Mm-hmm. And I think you got a little bit of pushback at a training, and I want to tell my story. Let's tell each story about some pushback.
Well, I'm the one that kind of offered the pushback in this one.
Okay.
Because I am a person, I don't like to interrupt. I want people to, in a sense, feel good about themselves. But sometimes those can be in conflict, though. Sorry. Like, to let someone just kind of talk at a time when it's detrimental to them, I think there's something irresponsible about that for mm-hmm. me as the provider. If I know the process and I see what it's doing to the process and I do nothing about it and I sit back and let it happen, that's concerning. While they might feel good with me letting them do that, they're going to also feel hopeless and despondent because now they're in a place where someone's supposed to help them do it different and for it to get better, but then they keep doing the same thing and it keeps getting worse. So that's a hard spot. So what Ryan's talking about is the story where I offered pushback was I recognized, like, wow, I was able to save some time right there in that session by one, in the way I kind of interrupt a story that's going on where I've kind of heard the theme. I listen for quick attachment themes and references, and I'll jump in and I'll say, wait a minute, I know you got so much more to tell, and I want to hear the details, but I cannot ignore what just came out of your mouth. You just said something about in this place, you are always left alone. And as you said it, I heard a shift in you. So I know you probably got more you want to add on, but I need to go towards that place when you're left alone and see what happens for you, what you do in that place, and can we send a clear signal to your partner? That's my kind of orientation with story now. I listen for the attachment experience or a scene to come alive. And I jump in and I apologize, but I need to get that part right. Because here's what I also say to my clients. Because I could hear that all the way out, but I need to respect your time and your resources. And if I let this go too long, I'm not going to have enough chance to work with that. And my guess is I've heard, because, by the way, we've said this in another episode, Ryan and I do make space to let them just tell their story early in the assessment process.
Sure, for sure.
In sessions like one and somewhat in their individual sessions and maybe even four and five, if it's a lot to it, we let them tell it.
Yeah.
And what we listen for is what are the themes?
Right.
What are the themes? And the themes of the negative cycle and the themes of their hopes and longings. And then once we've gotten that figured out, that's what we start. When I hear them start telling the story again, hey, I think this is that place you told me about before where you tried this and it just hasn't worked. So can I go towards that right now? And we work on that right now. And then if we have some time left, maybe you could tell me some more of that story. But I need to help you with this process right here, right now. That's my orientation to it.
Okay. And I was at a training on my side about, I don't know how long ago, 6 weeks ago from the time we're recording this today. And it was good. It was well handled. It was well done. This was I don't even know who the therapist was. And that therapist went to one of the facilitators, which is absolutely the, you know, appropriate way to handle this. And they were just sharing that the way I'm framing the idea of story puts them in a unique dilemma. Because they serve as a professional therapist with a native tribal nation. And in that culture, people's stories are crucial to them, right? Yes. Which I've heard of in some of my DEI trainings that native cultures, maybe a bit more than others, you know, they pass down their way of being in the oral tradition.
Yes.
Right. So if you just shut down their story, you're not going to be able to align. And the local therapist said, hey, help me with that. And so the facilitator brought that to me. And it was just a great discussion, which took me back to, maybe story is not the perfect word. But I would first start by saying we definitely want to hear those stories, especially in the assessment phase. You know, and if they don't tell me the story, I'm going to ask for it. And I'm going to tell them a little bit about my story. And we're going to take time to culturally attune. We're going to make space and broaching conversations for someone's marginalized experience, as well as culturally great, what makes you uniquely you. And so that is a major part of my answer. But I want to get into the second part of this answer after this break.
Do you like the content that you're hearing on this podcast? Well, we invite you to join us on successandvulnerability.com along with George Fowler and other EFT therapists and supervisors, where you get to get more thorough insight into these concepts and actually get to see it done. Once again, join us on successandvulnerability.com. All right. You know, we also, as you know, when we do these, you know, break times, we want to make sure we say thank you. Thank you for what you do as therapists, you know, whether you're, you know, an EFT therapist or not. What we do is hard work, you all. Particularly, you're listening to this podcast because we, more times than not, we talk about couples, relationships, and that's hard work. So we just want to take time to say thank you for committing to, one, if you're listening to this, giving extra time to perfect your craft. We appreciate you.
Yes, thank you very much. I especially am thankful for your very hard cases. I'm thankful for those cases in session 8, 9, 10, and 11, which are famous for people being very frustrated, impatient with the process, and just hanging in there, grinding with them, not giving up on seeing couples. So it's okay if people do as well, but those of us who hang in there, our world certainly needs people who can manage the difficulty of this. So thank you for hanging with your clients. Yeah, so, you know, again, with that tribal discussion, you know, for one, during our you know, assessment's not really a thing that ever fully ends, but we definitely, you know, first three or four sessions, we're making space for those things. But even when we're fairly far along, I would still make space for someone to say, you know, in my culture, in my world, this is what this means to me. And I would want to know that. I would want to make space for that. To me, that actually fits perfectly in affect assembly, which is right on our pathway to that.
Because that's meaning making.
It's meaning making, and it's model of self, and it's a lot. It's all around attachment.
That's right.
Right. I mean, that's what's great about tribes. That's a great word for where humans do well is when we fit in our tribe and we feel like we belong. So that's incredibly attachment rich. I probably wouldn't see those as stories. However, there is a timing where that's not helpful, even in that instance. And if my partner is in a very, very vulnerable place and I reference culture as a way for me not to show up for them, that's probably a block, right? And that will be one of many illustrations. Or if I'm trying to get you, if I'm trying to get a client to give sort of the rest of the story for their experience, so working and honoring their secondary emotion or whatever comes forward, but I'm also asking for a little bit of vulnerability, just a little bit, and they won't give that to me, to reference culture there might be a block. And that is something I hear a lot. In fact, it's almost universal. Almost everyone references their home, including me, references their home culture as to say, oh, we don't do that in our culture. I'm like, right. When there's lack of safety, nobody does vulnerability. My culture of being an athlete and, you know, that this kind of thing that I came through, you didn't see vulnerability. You didn't see attuned, comforting, responsive. If I turned my ankle, which I did like 100 times, and I'm laying there with my ankle swelling up, and my coach came out to me and said, are you all right? If I would have said, ah, coach, I'm really sad, he would have looked at me like I had 5 heads. And if he would have said, oh, I'm so sorry you've hurt yourself, I would have read that as he's making fun of me. So the culture I'm raised in, we didn't do any of this either. The problem is, as important as culture is, and as important as marginalization experiences and how that affects attachment, it is really important. It doesn't change the game. Because regardless of what my culture taught me, my neurology knows that I need to share my heart. Mm. I need to have important others respond to it. And so there is a universality that supersedes even the most important cultural dynamics. It's both, not one or the other.
And I hope I'm quoting her right, and I hope she gets to hear this. That helped me with this. Her name is, she's a great EFT supervisor out of Colorado. Her name is Liliana Balin. She does several things in EFT. She's an EFT supervisor, play therapy, EMDR. She's all over the place doing great things. But one thing she said to me, and she didn't say it just to me because I probably wouldn't share it here, she shared it publicly in a training that was, I think, a beautiful and honoring part here that came up. She said, you know, talks about her journey of learning EFT and experiencing some of it in her personal life. But then talking about the duality she experienced of, while I was learning EFT, I knew it was true. Going back to that, I felt the trueness of it in my own humanity. But also I felt this conflict of between what was true in my body and what I needed to do, and also my cultural experience. She just felt that duality. And she found a way to work that out to a way where it felt good and true for her. But anyway, that story popped up for me.
Yeah. And I love the idea of cultural humility. I find that to be one of the most useful concepts and terms that's come out of the DEI movement in other years. It's also tricky, though, because if I do a great job of leaning into your cultural experience and honor your marginalized experience and attune so much with how difficult it is to live in a world that's unequal or even abusive, mm-hmm. that's beautiful. That is an attachment thing. But if that's all I do, if I don't then push you to get a more clear signal out, I've also left you alone with that.
Immediately, when you said that, I could just picture like if Ryan was working with me and Nicola, yeah. Which there's a couple levels there because Nicola's not, her skin is brown, but she's right. Not a black woman. She's right. An immigrant from Jamaica who has at times felt like she belongs nowhere.
Right.
If you just do that, and I'm like, hey, Ryan, that's so beautiful. Thank you for being a white guy who has some cultural humility, who's willing to lean in and pay attention to these things. But I'm going home to distress and I don't know how to help my partner. That's where I'm like, thank you for that. That was really nice. You know, you get a sticker for the day, but help me.
So here's what's ironic. The question that came through that facilitator at that training is a therapist who shuts down the story, is that being a colonialist? Which is a term that I think is a really good discussion.
Yeah,
right. Looking at inequalities over the years and people that came from other countries and, you know, told the local people how they're supposed to be, or in the native population, literally moved them. I drive from two different places to my house, and I literally drive on the Trail of Tears. So it came through our hometown here, where we're recording this in Fayetteville, Arkansas. So that will be colonialism as its most literal. Here's what's tricky, though, is, let's see if I can say this right. I can totally make sense of, if I'm overly shutting down someone's story, that I am overpowering them or being like a colonialist. But here's the other problem. If I'm so culturally attuned that what I'm trying to get to is cultural resonance and cultural humility, which is beautiful and lovely, and I want to do those things, that can also be colonialist, because now I've set the goals for my clients.
Yes,
so
right.
Now I'm telling you, oh, this is what really matters, and what the goals that you have, now that's not as important as the cultural piece.
Mm-hmm.
You can say that's colonialist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's back to this attunement, the integrity of our attunement that we have of working with people and yet also being congruent with what they want.
There we go.
And their goal.
Yeah, and I want to shift a moment to this acronym you've got here, Ryan,
yes.
Because it's to help to talk about what's toxic. But if I were your supervisor, here's where I would be concerned. Like, if I was thinking like, okay, is this some self of the therapist issue? It would be, it's, okay, Ryan, hey, what happened right there? And it's what I'm going to be looking for is this like it made you uncomfortable?
Right.
Is this a place you didn't want to explore?
Right.
Because it was something that's not known to your experience?
Right.
Is it maybe that Ryan didn't even take a moment to even consider, hey, how does this tie in for my client? And is there a golden nugget here or something of that?
Right.
You know, and so that those would be things I would look for just to help me think like, or it's like, I don't see any value to it at all. I'm just moving on. Like, I remember one time we were working with an EFT supervisor and their client was military. And we were trying to like just get like a little bit of background, and the person was like, oh no, there's nothing there, there's no cultural elements. I'm like, I was in the military, and you better believe there's a lot of cultural elements around the rules around emotion, expression, strength, model of self, view of others. Oh, there's a whole lot. You need to take some time.
Yeah.
And I understand that this isn't something you've been in.
Yeah.
But like, that's where we need to say, it might not mean anything to you, but does it mean something to your client?
Right.
And particularly not just to their client, but also how is it affecting their relationship?
Yeah.
So
I love it. And that's a great discussion. Well, let's stay with that for 2 or 3 minutes, because it's so important that we attune with macro and micro culture, right? Because there are macro culture pieces that are just, they just are, right? So Nicola is a great example of that. She may not socially locate herself as black or brown skin. She may identify as an islander or a Caribbean islander or an immigrant. But at the macro culture, she still may receive the same discrimination as a black person. I think she said that to me before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a macro culture piece that I want to make space for.
Mm-hmm.
And both how she experiences the world, how it affects her attachment strategy with her partner, and then with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to recognize and examine my own bias as a person of power, privilege, a white person, a bald person with a beard, all the ways people respond to me, even if I don't see myself that way. So it is really important. But sometimes we can attune that so much that we miss microculture, because she was also a military person.
That's
and
right.
She also had these experiences which shape her reality and shape her model of self and other
mm-hmm.
that we want to pay attention to.
Yep.
And she also is paying me to pursue a goal if she's my client.
That's right.
And so I think that's where it's so tricky and so important to try to stay with that. And I just want to say, and hopefully this comes across clear, but you never know. I think that the question, it wasn't really a critique, but let's pretend it was, that I got that training was right. I think I had not done a good enough job, especially as a person of power,
that's right.
of emphasizing in the assessment phase, you know, the dedicated time for assessment, that we need to make sure we're I talked about it, but not enough, clearly, to be clear, though. So it was great feedback. I thought that was really, really helpful.
Good job.
And so one of the things I know that what you're probably thinking right now is, man, I wish we had more acronyms in EFT. Well, I got good news. Here comes another one. So what the spirit of what we're trying to do here is to help a therapist, maybe particularly a young therapist, or young meaning number of years, identify and become proficient at identifying, hey, is this person's response Is this something that is needed and helpful? You know, might I marginalize this person mm-hmm. by not making space enough for this story? Or is this an area where the client needs me to kind of take a stronger, wiser other, not against the client, but against the cycle? And so we made an acronym called DEBS. I don't know why we did that, but let's just say it anyway. So I'm not expecting anyone to remember this, but I think it's a dialogue. It's mm-hmm. a conversation which might be helpful. So, and really either side, right? So everything we're asking an EFT, other than the assessment processes, is either going for cognitive restructuring or here and now emotional processing, for lack of a better way to say that. And so it can be either one when these stories come out. When I'm trying to do an affect assembly mm-hmm. and they change the subject, or when I'm trying to go into emotion and a story or a summary came out. We just watched James practice today in the Success and Vulnerability Live, and I watched your male client just block you almost endlessly with story, 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 more story, and not enough story, it was more story. And little summaries that's always just sort of holding the process at arm's length, which is exactly what gets him hurt. And don't forget that. This is the reason mm. we're trying to learn to contain story, is it gets people hurt. Mm-hmm. But the type of story we're talking about, the DEBS, mm-hmm. stands for disembodied, and I put a slash there, or disembodied philosophy. Mm. I can't tell you how many times I'm like, so what message do you get? It's one of my favorite questions in EFT. When X, Y, and Z bad happens, what message does that send to you mm-hmm. about who you are in this person's world? And someone starts quoting Gottman, right? And I love Gottman. I was trained with Gottman in Seattle, and it's important research, but it's the timing of that. And it's so disembodied. Mm-hmm. They're not staying with their experience.
That's it.
Yeah. And so disembodied or disembodied philosophy. And then E is an exit, right? It's learning to listen for, man, that is a whole exit from vulnerability or from the map of change that they are paying me for. And the B is blame. I see a fair amount of people enacting. The therapist sets up an enactment, what is effectively blame. That is a very low probability that's going to be effective. And so blame is something you got to read into. It's really negative model of other. You don't want to enact that very often. Blame's going to happen. I invite it into my room, but I want to work with it between that person and me. And I don't want to assume that a story that's really blame is taking us on the map. I do a two-part, two S's here at the end of DEBS.
Oh.
So one, I like what you wrote there, is that it actually sabotages connection with self or other. And then the second S is just simple. I just wrote something else, right? It's just like I'm trying to get something clear. I'm trying to go a direction with this. And it's like, no, we're going to talk about something else.
Oh, that's what mine kept doing to me today.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So there's DEBS, D-E-B-S-S, disembodied, exit, blame, sabotages connection, or just something else.
So this is, if I'm understanding you right, Ryan, now it's like, because once words are just so representative and they can be broad, but when you say story or toxic story,
yes,
this now is your way of, this is the meaning when you say it.
That's what I'm referring to.
Gotcha.
Because other stories that aren't this way have certain value. Okay. You know, and here's where this acronym may have some value. I definitely don't want you thinking of this in session. Hopefully that's obvious. But when you're watching video, mm-hmm. which I hope we're all doing, that'd be a good place to go, man, that person just told a story. Like, mm-hmm. well, was it embodied? Mm-hmm. You know, was it like in the moment or was it more philosophical? Mm-hmm. You know, was it just an exit? Was there a lot of blame? Right. So just looking through this, which develops, a felt sense of like, okay, this is more of a DEBS moment. Mm-hmm. And when I have a DEBS moment, again, a metaphor I use a lot is, it's like being a driver's ed instructor mm-hmm. and you got a sweet 16-year-old who's trying their best, but they're a little disoriented. If they start taking the car towards a concrete barrier, mm-hmm. let's don't see how it plays out. Mm-hmm. once I realize, hey, this is a DEBS moment, I need to hit the brakes. Mm-hmm. I need to find an honoring way to interrupt and to reset us back to where they are. And oftentimes what you'll find is they'll thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Your client thanked you.
That's right.
He can tell in his body, I'm off track. I'm disoriented. I don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
So,
man, can I say, so one, thank you for this. I will think of this in session. That's just how my brain works. Okay. But here's why, especially the first one. This makes me think about something I even wrote on my social media page for thinking about my black clients. And this also comes from the work Eugene Gindlin. I appreciate his work. Is people can be telling you a story that has meaning, but they're telling it without the experience. Mm. And I feel like that's traumatizing.
Mm.
I'm trying to think about, you know, my clients who have been through sexual trauma, and they can talk about what happened to them in like a data point type way. Well, this, and then this person, and then that person, but then I just kind of went on with my life. Hold up. So I appreciate like to catch, so I might think of Debs and I hear like, wait, they're telling me a story that's loaded. It's about racism and discrimination. Like, you can't tell that story naturally. Yeah. So I would say something. Can I go back?
Mm-hmm.
And I find this a lot with my black clients. And this was the post I made, is I hope part of our healing is that we can learn to reoccupy our own bodies with our stories.
Yeah.
We don't have to tell disembodied stories. Mm-hmm. And I want to be sensitive here when I say it. It's my story is more than what other people did to me. It's how I chose to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is I learned from me. Now this is getting personal to James. Like, wait a minute, James. Make sure when you tell your story, you honor you, even if other people don't see you. When you tell your story, honor you, even if other people don't. So I think about this is great with our clients, because I think when I'm working with my black clients, and they might be telling me about it, like, whoa, hold on. You just told me about what you went through.
Right.
And you told it as a matter of fact way. But I need to go back.
Yeah.
Can we tell that story again? And can you tell me what it's like to be you in that space?
I like it. And that disembodied telling makes sense.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's, safety. That is a trauma response.
That's right.
And had I walked through that person's shoes, I would assume I'd be, if I talked about it at all, mm-hmm. I would probably want to talk about it in a disembodied way. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a largely black area.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a single friend who didn't experience both overt and systematic racism.
Mm-hmm.
So I can totally see how the accumulative effect of that over these years would make me want to talk about it at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, but then that might be incongruent with my goals.
That's right.
Because I want things to change.
Yep.
Right. So this is where we sit in this intersection with them,
mm-hmm.
Of trying to make space and trying to hold space and honor their story, yet also be loyal to their goal.
That's right.
Because that's exactly I don't want to be a colonialist.
That's right. Exactly right. And right. I tell my clients that. And one of a black male client, he said, thank you, James. I didn't even realize. And this is the thing that was got me. He said, I didn't even realize I was doing that to myself.
Nice.
That was a big one.
Nice.
I did not realize I was doing that to myself.
Yeah.
Next one I want to give
is, that's so good. I got to comment. That's so good. That my brain runs on that one. Because that's the racial trauma.
Yeah.
Right. And then, so then it's like this cycle within self.
Mm-hmm.
Like I, the longer I'm here, I'm not even where I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've learned from thy pain for so long to take my heart offline. Now I've lost sensitivity that's even happening. This just becomes like breathing.
That's right.
Yeah. That's good, man. I'm glad you were able to be in that space.
Yeah. And the other one I want to say, it makes me think about the intervention from Sue. And Sue is so good when her clients, maybe the way she might go to a block, she's like, hold on. Right as we begin to talk about that place, and I'm almost find myself doing the Sue voice, sorry. Hold on. Right as we talk about that place, look at what you go to. You start telling me this. You start telling me that. And what she's trying to do is she's kind of using reflection to show you the process. Hey, right as we touch this place, you start telling me this, you start telling me that, you know, and she could be curious, like, help me understand this. How does this fit in right here? And it is doing something like, right as I start touching your pain about what happens for you here, you start telling me the story about your partner. And I don't know, this is where you could take a risk. I'm going to take a risk and conject something. Now, this is James entering and Sue has exited the room. I don't know, is this kind of moment right here is because there's something important you need me to see that's scary for you? Or is this a way of kind of your body getting some pressure and kind of like getting of your body kind of trying to get you out of here? Just help me understand. Help me understand so we can stay focused here. And that's hard because that's also dealing with the exiting. Maybe it could be dealing with blame, but also where it's like the something else. But anyway, y'all, we're trying to do better with time, but this was a good topic, and we have completely blown time today. You probably like, well, I'm no longer in the drop-off line. I am now in my office drinking my third cup of coffee. So anyway.
Thanks for being with us.
You have anything else here, Ryan?
That's it, man. It's such an important topic.
Yeah,
When I watch these cases that are the hardest cases, so often I hear people blaming big concepts like addiction or affairs, and those are really big deals. Mm-hmm. But when you hit play, what often happens is the therapist is doing a good job, mm-hmm. and one of these Deb stories comes in and just blows the whole thing up. And 36 weeks later, we're nowhere. You know, and these people are suffering. So it's so important that we refine our eyes and ears and our bodies to be able to identify when what comes forward is helpful and congruent with their goal, mm-hmm. Versus when it's really coming out of an inadvertent protective system, which hurts them.
That's right. And so I think that's one, as we close, two things. One, it's the heart, I think, for me right now, as I'm sitting here and I find out, like, why is this important? Why I'm running over time? It's because of this. I want to help you in your desire to help your clients. That's one. It's trying to help you as therapists, because I know for me, and you might be in a different place, I have it I treat, particularly, you know, me and Ryan, we work in a nonprofit. So some of our clients paying for therapy, not a problem. Some of them, serious issue. So this is what I take seriously. I want to use their time and financial resources as a good steward, and not waste 1 ounce of it if I can. That's one. And then number two is me, when we're talking about this, we're not telling you to take your client's story away, because there's a very sacred moments and times to use those. But when you're drowning is not the time. When you're drowning in emotional and relational distress, that's probably not the best time to just go over a story. Help get me stabilized, and I'll go find my story, and I'll tell my story. But while I'm drowning, that's not the time to talk about a story, for me at least. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also locating the appropriate timing.
Yeah.
So we're holding space for the sacredness. And what we're saying is, in this specific moment,
yeah,
when your clients are trying to do vulnerable work to repair their relationship,
yeah,
that's where we're getting really super focused.
Yeah. Timing is really important.
Yes.
When it comes forward. And perhaps this is obvious, forgive me for being insulting, but the opposite of Deb's tells you it's the opposite thing.
That's right.
If a story is embodied,
Stay with it.
If it's not an exit, if it's not blame ridden, if it's not sabotaging connection, I need to get curious.
And if it's taking us into more, because that's where I sometimes let my clients, and Ryan taught this on a podcast, give it 5 to 6 sentences to watch the direction. And if those 5 to 6 sentences keep dropping them into more vulnerability, we are going to shut up and be quiet. Mm. Literally are, because attachment's working. It doesn't need me to intervene. Mm-hmm. But if I find it going away, blame coming in, I see that person, they're ramping up, and I see their partner shutting down, then I got to do something.
Yeah.
I got to do something.
One practical point, since we're already over. When one of these Deb stories comes in, it's not because your clients are trying to be difficult.
That's right.
I'm not going to call this resistance. We have called it a block, but blocks are, you know, they're welcomed. They're important. Every Deb's story, while not useful, it does have a function. Mm. And so when I interrupt, I'm going to interrupt with them, not against them. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be curious with them. In previous episodes, we used acronyms like CPR. So I'm going to try to catch it with an interruption. I'm going to try to be curious with them for 3 or 4 sentences, how this exit makes good sense. Usually it's trying to protect themselves or other, their relationship. Be curious with them before I go back to the reset. So hopefully that's obvious, but it's really crucial that we respond to it in that way.
Thank you for listening. We hope this experience helps you push the leading edge in your work to help people connect with themselves and with each other. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can contact us at pushtheleadingedge@gmail.com. And you can follow us on our Facebook page at Push the Leading Edge. You can follow Ryan on Facebook at Ryan Reyna Professional Training and on his website, RyanReynaTraining.com. You can follow James on Facebook and Instagram at DocHawkLPC. You can also check out his website, DocHawkLPC.com.